A warning, this story touches on sensitive issues and may not be suitable for all listeners. I'm Andy Richards, a journalist with the Birmingham Mail, and this is the first episode in our podcast series, The Lonely Death of Janet Parker, marking the 40th anniversary of the last person in the world to die from smallpox. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, smallpox was the scourge of the earth. It killed one in five people, and where it didn't kill, it often left people horribly disfigured. They were maimed, could be left blind, infertile, susceptible to other diseases. Just a dreadful thing. And so the World Health Organization decided they were going to take this thing on once and for all. And they set themselves an ambitious target: to rid the whole earth of this dreadful virus, once and for all, forever, for good. There were thousands of medics involved in this project. They were extremely dedicated, extremely brave people. I mean, they went absolutely everywhere. Really dangerous places, remote places, places where there was civil war, places where there was political wrangling, all those kind of things. And they were determined that they were going to vaccinate absolutely everyone. And one of the people involved was Professor Henry Bedson. He was based at the University of Birmingham, and he went to Afghanistan and Pakistan as part of one of the teams working out there. But as it turned out, his own lab at the university would ultimately prove to be even more dangerous. The World Health Organization were successful. They totally eradicated it from absolutely everywhere. Took them 20 years. Wonderful medical triumph. And nowadays, outside their headquarters in Geneva, there's a bronze statue, and it depicts four figures, and one of them's a doctor, and another one's a little girl, and one of them's having a vaccination. And the statue is dedicated to all those people, both involved in the eradication process, those people who were infected by smallpox, those people who lost their lives. And of course, one of the people that means that the statue is dedicated to is Professor Henry Bedson, who ultimately paid with his life for the work that he did.
Now, there's no absolute guarantee against smallpox, but if children are vaccinated as babies and once or twice afterwards, they're very unlikely to get it. But you must remember that by the time your children are grown up, air travel will be general, and the danger of smallpox, which comes from abroad, even greater than it is today.
So smallpox was a disease that people caught from other people. It was a disease of humans. Generally, to catch it, you had to have been in close contact with another human. Kind of rule of thumb was in perhaps 2 metres of another person.
That was Professor Mark Pallon, author of the book The Last Days of Smallpox, Tragedy in Birmingham. Smallpox, also known as variola major, began as a flu-like illness.
You're hot and sweating, and then you're shivering, and it's generally prostrating. It's not one where you can wander around and do your day-to-day job. Anyone who's had flu, real flu, knows the same symptoms. It's not something you can say, well, I think I'll go and watch telly or something like that, or I'll read that book I never got round to reading. You just go to bed and you're in this kind of fitful, disturbed sleep, in and out of it, and feeling dreadful. And that's what smallpox was like to start with.
Then there was the rash that typically started in the mouth and spread across the face. Then it travelled across the body to the arms and legs and out to the hands and feet.
I'd like to show you what smallpox really looks like, but I should warn you, it's not a very pleasant sight.
After a day or so, the florid red rash hardened into raised spots called papules.
The papules would then start to fill with fluid, which would start off a bit like a kind of blister, which we call a vesicle, clear fluid. And then as the body was starting to fight the inflammation and there was damage to the tissues and dead bits of tissue and stuff, that would then all become cloudy and would form what we call a pustule. Effectively, those blisters were filled with pus. There was a feeling in the skin of intense kind of prickliness, like kind of bad sunburn.
Everything's all right, isn't it? Your child's out of danger, all right. But I think I ought to warn you, her face will be marked for life.
Then those pustules, eventually the tops would slough off and they'd discharge their contents. They'd crust over and turn into dry crust. The crusts themselves and the pustule contents were laden with smallpox virus so that they would be very infectious until the last crust had sloughed off. Typically, many of those pustules will have formed scars, and those scars form what we call the pock marks.
Smallpox seemed to hit people at random. Here's Professor Sir Hugh Pennington, a microbiologist and virologist.
It was a horrible disease that basically killed lots of people and struck almost at random, if you like. Okay, there were outbreaks, but it was a disease you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy, let's put it like that. It's the luck of the draw, unfortunately, or the bad luck of the draw, that 20% of people die. You can't tell which is going to be the 20 and which is going to be the 80 in a group of cases.
The literature suggests that smallpox goes back to ancient times, but Mark Pallon thinks the numbers are sometimes exaggerated.
Very commonly cited a statistic that smallpox killed 300 to 500 million people in the 20th century alone. I've never seen a scholarly source for those figures. I tend to think that we can't say much about infectious diseases before the modern era of microbiology, when we can grow things and store them and characterise them. I think the first time we can say probably it really did come into being a serious threat was in the early modern era, perhaps around the time that Europeans moved to the New World. There were infectious diseases in the New World brought by Europeans that killed lots of the Native Americans, and probably smallpox played a role in that. But I tend to be sceptical generally about what you can say in the past. It's clear it was a terrible disease and it killed lots of people and it caused untold misery. But I do worry that we sometimes try and make out it's really ancient and really prevalent when perhaps it wasn't quite as much.
Smallpox outbreaks had happened before in the UK.
You know, being an old colonial power with, you know, lots and lots of interest in the Indian subcontinent, where smallpox was still pretty busy until not long before eradication, people would come in from the Indian subcontinent, perhaps to meet relatives, and bring the virus with them. So we had more outbreaks in the UK than most of the European countries because of this travel between the Indian subcontinent, between parts of the world where smallpox was still common.
In 1966, Tony McLennan, a medical photographer at the University of Birmingham, contracted variola minor, a milder form of the disease, but soon recovered. At the time, nobody made much of the fact that he worked above the smallpox lab at the university. But 12 years later, another photographer would catch smallpox there too, and this time, the consequences would be far more tragic.
You're home on leave from the East, aren't you?
That's right. Been back nearly 3 weeks.
Did you bring anything with you?
Apart from your normal equipment, I mean.
One or two odds and ends for the wife. A couple of necklaces. Oh, I picked up a rag doll for Pat.
Where? In the market?
Yes. Can a thing carry infection?
Oh, yes. It's quite possible.
One of the biggest sort of events in smallpox eradication was Ali Mal-Mil in Somalia in 1977, who was the last case in the world of smallpox. Very mild case, but he was the last case of smallpox, naturally acquired smallpox. People thought it had been eradicated a little before, and then suddenly it appeared. There was a good political consensus that this was something that everybody should sign up to. Anyway, Ali Mal-Mil was the last case, and he survived. He had this mild case, and there are pictures of him looking quite healthy, you know, with his spots.
Smallpox had all but been eradicated across the globe. The ongoing work on smallpox in laboratories, the careful harnessing, classification and production of vaccines carried out by dedicated virologists across the world would soon come to an end. In 1980, the WHO declared that the dreaded disease had finally been completely eradicated.
The word went out that if you had any smallpox virus vials in your freezer, you know, you got rid of them. You know, the word came round, and then the word came round again that we had to get rid of the virus. So there wasn't any chance of a sort of Birmingham incident happening by accident.
The Birmingham incident in 1978 was to claim two lives. Janet Parker was the last person in the world to die of smallpox. And with her death came more tragic consequences. Professor Henry Bedson was the head of the microbiology department at Birmingham University Medical School. Bedson's grandfather and father were famous microbiologists as well, so science was in his DNA. Hugh Pennington again.
I knew Professor Henry Bedson. I stayed in his house because I was the PhD examiner of Linda Harper, who was working on smallpox at the time of the escape. And he put me up in his house, and we had a very pleasant evening. I met his family and his children and had a long chat. I didn't know him particularly well before then, but we'd been obviously professional colleagues and working on very similar things. The technique I'd been using, which was basically separating proteins of viruses using a technique called polyacrylamide gel electrophoresis, was something that Linda Harper was doing. She was using it to analyze smallpox viruses and seeing how closely related they were to other non-smallpox but closely related viruses like monkeypox and so on. And so that's why Henry asked me to come and examine her PhD, because the techniques we were using were exactly the same. So Henry was a bit of a sort of boffin, I suppose you could say, in that old, you know, backroom person, quiet sort of guy, very highly respected. And of course he came from a very highly respected family. I mean, his father had some organism, the Bedsoni, called after him. I mean, they're called something else now, but, you know, he was a very distinguished bacteriologist, and his grandfather was a chemist and university professor. So he came from this long succession of very eminent scientists. I wouldn't say that Henry was of the kind of Nobel quality. He wasn't going to make big, big discoveries. He was more of the sort of, I suppose you could say, and I'm not being rude, I don't think, he was more of a sort of journeyman scientist. Dotting the I's, crossing the T's, making sure everything's right, doing really good work, fundamentally important work, rather than work that was going to be a breakthrough, let's put it like that. Who knows, though? Because, you know, you need luck to do that.
When Hugh returned to Scotland from Henry's lab, he thought it was best to vaccinate himself.
I got some vaccine and just banged it into my arm, yes. And it didn't take, because I already had immunity anyway. But I just wanted to be on the safe side, because I knew that smallpox immunity after a vaccine doesn't last forever. It wanes, and different people it will wane at different rates, and there's no way of telling. You may have been vaccinated a few years before, which I had been, but I wasn't absolutely certain that the vaccine immunity had lasted, so just to be on the safe side. I just thought, well, here is something I can do. You know, my daughter had just been born. You know, why expose my wife and my daughter to a virus unnecessarily when you can do something about it? And that's always a good principle. If you can do something about it, you do it.
The lab at the university had played an important role in the diagnosis and control of smallpox in the Midlands. But by 1978, the work of Bedson and his small team of virologists was mainly to compare smallpox with other animal pox viruses.
They were really trying to classify the viruses, the smallpox viruses, the classical nasty smallpox viruses, and these other related viruses. Monkeypox was the name that was given to them, but you know they come from other animals as well. So that basically, the worry, I think, was that these viruses, they're out in sort of Central Africa and places like that, and they may cause infections in humans. It's very important to be able to tell whether they are smallpox or not, whether smallpox has gone away and hidden somewhere, whether these viruses are going to mutate into viruses like smallpox. It's absolutely crucial to classify them and basically do detailed fingerprints on them, because the methods that were being used up to that time, they weren't reasonably well, but they were, by today's standards, they were hopelessly crude. This was before the days of DNA typing, which now you could do it in a few hours anyway. It was before those days. The protein analysis using the polyacrylamide gels was coming along leaps and bounds and was a very good way of giving you a very good indication of whether virus A was very closely related to virus B or was very different from virus B. The World Health, I know, thought very highly of the work. It was work that needed to be done just to sort of wrap up smallpox completely so that we didn't worry about these viruses coming out of monkeys in the jungle or rats or whatever it was, being confused with smallpox, and they weren't smallpox either, but we had to be absolutely certain of that so that we could basically not rest content, but at least know exactly where we stood with these viruses, these wild viruses, non-human viruses that did occasionally affect people.
It was there in late summer 1978 in room EG34B at the University of Birmingham that Bedson was working on a particularly potent strain of smallpox. It was named Arbid for the young Pakistani boy whose life it had claimed.
you know, this was a fairly typical, what you call Asiatic smallpox, you know, the classical kind of smallpox that used to kill 20% of the people it infected. It didn't matter how old you were, you know, you had a 20% chance of having a bad end when you were infected with it, and there was no treatment. So it was on that, out of that family of viruses, and it was very important to do that work on viruses of that kind so that you had this background information where you could compare the results with, for example, some new virus appearing out of the jungle in Africa.
But the lab was in its last days. A series of letters had passed between Bedson and the WHO after an inspection of the smallpox lab had raised some safety concerns.
The Birmingham lab wasn't a particularly dodgy lab. I think the problem with the Birmingham lab was it was working with a particularly dodgy virus. Henry told me about the problems he was having with the World Health basically not giving him a seal of approval because the laboratory conditions just didn't come up to their standards, and how he would have to stop his program of research on smallpox, basically, because he wasn't going to get the approval for his laboratory. You know, he was obviously quite upset about that, but he had to accept it because clearly smallpox had pretty well disappeared. It had been eradicated by that time. The last case had actually happened. There weren't going to be any more cases. We were pretty certain about that. So getting any money to do this kind of work would be very, very difficult. He had some grants, but clearly that was the end of the road for that sort of work on smallpox. Not necessarily on other pox viruses able to cause infections in humans, but it was the end of the road for that.
In a letter written in the spring of 1978, Henry responded to the WHO. You can sense his frustration.
We're now putting most of our effort into the polyacrylamide gel electrophoresis studies in order to get as much of the smallpox-whitepox comparisons completed before we have to give up our work with these viruses. Progress has been a little slowed while we filled in some of the necessary controls, but we are now in a position to get ahead both more quickly and, I hope, intelligently. I hope that it is clearly understood that, while we are satisfied that what we are doing is sensible and secure and has been approved by our national bodies, our facilities in no way match those set out for the definitive smallpox labs in your workshop report. It would be expensive and very costly in time if we were to try and establish such a laboratory, and quite unjustified in view of our projected halt to the smallpox, whitepox work at the end of the year.
Several letters passed between them on the subject of the lab closure. The last letter Henry received from the WHO was in August 1978. Letter from Dr. Arita.
I note that your letters had been written when the case in Birmingham had not come to your notice. I hope this will be variola virus's last revenge, just as it is being exterminated. I am sure you must be feeling very tired these days, but take heart and think what constructive steps can now be taken.
Dr. Arita was referring to the news that had just hit Birmingham. Back from his holiday, Henry was in for a nasty shock. 40-year-old Janet Parker worked as a medical photographer in the office above Bedson's pox lab at the university. Mark Pallon again.
Janet Parker was born in 1938. She grew up in Birmingham in those post-war years. I think hers really was the first generation to call themselves teenagers. She had a grammar school education. About a third of people went to grammar school after passing the 11 plus. When she left school, she started working as a photographer and settled into a job working for the police. She was often required to go to the courtroom to present her evidence. It wasn't allowed to be just presented anonymously, so she was known to people in the courtroom.
Barrister QC Brian Escott Cox knew Janet Parker.
I met Janet Parker on several occasions, always within the formality of the courtroom, but enough to establish a nice collegial association. She worked for the Birmingham City Police before she moved to the university. She was an extremely pleasant, agreeable and attractive young woman with a very pleasant sort of glow about her, I think is the best way I can put it. Very, very nice lady.
Janet married Joseph Parker, a post office engineer, in 1965. They soon settled into domestic life in Kings Norton with their dogs. They both drove British Triumph cars, Janet's a nifty Spitfire sports car. Janet's parents, Fred and Hilda Whitcomb, lived nearby in Myrtle Avenue.
She took up a job at the University of Birmingham after several years working for the police because she wanted more regular hours, I think, as she settled into married life. She was the sort of person that wanted to better herself, so she was studying at the Open University, and the reputation she had was that she was a fairly even-headed person, a reliable individual, quite agreeable. She was part of a coffee club with her colleagues.
Being an extremely pleasant and sociable person, I've no doubt that she mixed with her colleagues and was very popular with them. And they must have been absolutely devastated by what happened.
One Friday in August, it was Friday the 11th of August, Janet started to feel unwell. It was the last day of the week, and although she was feeling pretty unwell, she went into work. She had all the typical signs of a flu-like illness. She would have had headache, backache. She would have felt flushed 1 minute, and then the next minute probably a bit shivery. She'd have had a fever. But she went into work that one day. The next day she felt a bit better. She felt well enough to go out for a little walk in the afternoon. But by the Sunday she'd taken to her bed, and over the coming days, a number of doctors were called out, 3 of them in total. Her parents felt that she was not really doing very well, and they decided that they would look after her, so she went and moved a few days after her illness. They were so alarmed by the course of her illness that they called in their GP, who took a fresh look at her. That was when the alarm was raised.
Ambulance serviceman John Richmond and his colleague George Pepple were called to the scene.
We were on the road and it was coming up to finishing time. I think it was about 3 o'clock. And they called us up on the radio and they said, yes, we've got one sitting case for you. A query infectious. And it was from Myrtle Avenue. I'll never forget it. Myrtle Avenue, Woolstock. So we get there and it was a little cul-de-sac, a little grove. And I parked the motor there and George went up to have a look, as we always did, and he come down and tell me what we wanted, a stretcher or whatever. And I waited there and he came out and he said, gosh, you want to see this woman? And I said, what's the matter with her? He said, you come and have a look. He said, we want a chair at least to carry her down the stairs. I said, I thought it was a sitting case. He said, well, you come and have a look. We went upstairs and this poor woman, I felt, she's about my age, she was lying in bed. And do you know what a wart is, don't you? You know, when you get a wart on it. If you can imagine somebody's body covered like that, all over, that's exactly how she was. And as regards standing, she couldn't even stand at the bed.
Janet was taken to East Birmingham Hospital, where doctors puzzled over the symptoms she was presenting. Here's Hugh Pennington again.
Even 40 years ago, 50 years ago, doctors had great trouble in recognising a case of smallpox just by looking at the patient. And, of course, chickenpox was often confused with smallpox. Chickenpox is reasonably common. Well, it used to be reasonably common. And so making a clinical diagnosis of smallpox was never going to be terribly easy. Once you were into an outbreak, it was much easier. And, of course, the Department of Health had smallpox experts who would be called in if there was the knowledge that there might be smallpox about. They would call in the smallpox experts who would come and look at the patient and pass a clinical opinion. You would just take a scraping of one of the spots and look at it under the electron microscope. It doesn't take very long. But to do that, you have to think, could this be smallpox? And that was the problem. Once you'd made that, come up with that thought, it followed reasonably easily after that, but you had to have the thought in the first place.
Dr. Deborah Simmons had just started work on the 1st of August 1978 as Senior House Officer for Infectious Diseases at East Birmingham Hospital. She came to see Janet in the ward. Her first impression was that Janet didn't seem too unwell, but that her rash was horrific. Like her colleagues, Deborah Simmons was perplexed. A smallpox expert was called in.
That was a guy called Alistair Geddes, who was from Scotland originally, but had settled in the West Midlands for the best part of a decade and had been working as an infectious disease physician at the East Birmingham Hospital. And he got a sum of money that was paid to him every time he went out and saw a patient who might have smallpox. And he'd done this on several occasions, and every occasion up till then, it had been a false alarm. From the end of the bed, this looked to him like smallpox. He had seen smallpox because he had been to Bangladesh a few years earlier during the Bangladesh phase of the eradication campaign. Alistair also was aware of a crucial fact here, that she was working in the medical school at the University of Birmingham, and he knew people were working on the smallpox virus in the laboratories in that medical school at that very same time. So he then immediately said, right, well, this really does look like smallpox. The definitive diagnosis could only come from the laboratory. And it turned out that the smallpox lab in Birmingham had a dual purpose. It was a place in which research was being done, but it was also a diagnostic lab for the region. By chance, it happened that the head of the lab, Henry Bedson, was on call that night as the duty virologist who would be there if a diagnosis needed to be made. And what happened back in those days was that if a sample was taken from a patient, say scrapings from a skin lesion, a skin spot, this would be prepared in a certain way and then put under the electron microscope, a very powerful microscope, which allowed you to see down below the level of cells and actually visualise viruses. And the smallpox virus had a characteristic shape under the electron microscope. It described a bit like a brick shape. That's what they were looking for.
Alistair handed the samples over to Professor Bedson. He and Deborah Simmons left Bedson in the lab to test the slides under the electron microscope. The next time they saw Professor Bedson, he was silent and deathly white.
And a short while later, they went into the electron microscope room to find Henry Bedson sitting at the electron microscope, transfixed, just looking at the screen in a kind of trance, really in a state of shock, I think. He wouldn't respond to their initial questioning. Alistair had to sort of gently push him out of the way so he could look himself and see what was going on. And it was at that stage that Alistair saw what was on that microscope. He said that normally you expect to see the smallpox virus looking like a brick, and you might see a few bricks. What he saw that day was instead a building site's worth of bricks. It was at that point that Henry Bedson also had made the connection. It was clear in his mind that this was almost certainly smallpox, and it must have come from his lab. There was nowhere else it could have come from.